From the Electro Library podcast studio at Stonehill College, I'm Jarrett Green, and this is Short Circuits, one author in the spotlight, generating electricity, shooting off sparks.
I'm so happy that Ada is with us today. Ada Limone is the author of 6 books of poetry, including The Carrying, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. Her most recent book of poetry, The Hurting Kind, is out now from Milkweed Editions. She's the 24th Poet Laureate of the United States. As the Poet Laureate, her signature project is called You Are Here and focuses on how poetry can help connect us to the natural world. In October of 2023, she was awarded a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. In June of 2022, the Librarian of Congress, Carla Hayden, appointed Ada Limone to be the 24th Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry, also known as the U.S. Poet Laureate. The position has existed as part of the Library of Congress for over 80 years and was named by an act of Congress. To find out more about the laureateship, you can visit the library's website. The poem that made me fall in love with Ada Limone's work is a poem called "Please, Oh Please Let It Be Lightning," about two people driving in a car. This poem makes me remember car rides where I felt this way about people who are no longer here. Grateful I still am. When I reach the last lines, tears usually spring up, and not because I'm sad, but because I'm alive and have been younger and want to remain willing to be struck by something shining and mad. Her poems are conduits that connect us to our human experience with an embodied urgency that implores us to notice and be present for both grief and wonder and the way that nature surprises us. To bring our awareness to our corporeal selves and to the world in which our bodies live. Her poems feel like meditations or prayers. In an interview with the great poet Mary Oliver, she said, "I got saved by poetry and I got saved by the beauty of the world." Ada's poems make me feel like she too might say something like this, and that she offers up her poems so that we might also find salvation in the beauty and see our connection to it and to its destruction. To call upon interconnectedness can feel like a radical stance given the precarious state of our planet today. To pay attention is often heartbreaking and difficult. She said once that poetry is a place where we can explore and examine our rage. Poetry is a place where we can admit to an unknowing, which is something that we don't easily do as people who often feel compelled to summarize and reduce in quipped transmissions. I think of the Zen koan that states, "Not knowing is most intimate." This is the intimacy that draws me to Ada's work, that makes me feel part of it, part of something larger than myself. She makes a place for writing what we know and towards and all we don't understand, always curious. If we stay curious, if we can trust in the not knowing, then our awareness can expand and be as vast as space. If we make space around the darkness, we can let in a lot more light. I'm so grateful that Ada is joining me in conversation today about her work on this day of the solar eclipse. I wonder if you, Ada, have any eclipse thoughts? Have you been thinking about it, or how are you kind of internalizing it or greeting this day today?
Yeah, I love that everything you just said in the introduction was so beautiful. And I really just want to express my gratitude for the care you take with my work. And it's really a thing to be beheld. And I appreciate that so much. You know, I thought, of course, it's hard not to think about the eclipse. I've been thinking about it for a little while, about trying to even see if I would drive to, you know, I probably about 2.5 hours from the path of totality. But I think with everything that I've got going on and flying tomorrow, that it's just a little difficult to do for me to take that time. But I am, I'm interested in shadow. And so I think that the eclipse, of course, is, a huge, huge celestial event, if you will. And yet it feels like the work of poets, which is that recognition of the shadow. And I think that's what's been on my heart today.
I just reread Annie Dillard's essay, The Eclipse, and it's so fantastic, that darkness that she describes, and she opens with it being like a death, and I really love thinking about that.
Beautiful essay, yeah.
I wondered, just because when we had you at Stonehill, you didn't get a chance to read Oh, Please Let It Be Lightning. Would you read that for me today?
I would absolutely, it's a pleasure to read that poem.
Thank you so much.
This is a poem that it came out of a true story, which is that my husband's mother said that they didn't know if there was a if the great if their her great grandmother had died in childbirth or was struck by lightning. And I thought, wow, what a huge difference between those two things. And then, of course, as a poet, I had to take that image and think about it. And then I think eventually it turned, without me trying to, it turned into a love poem. And not just a love poem between two people, but a love poem between you and the life that you're living. Oh, please let it be lightning. We were crossing the headwaters of the Susquehanna River in our new car we didn't quite have the money for, but it was slick and silver, and we named it after the local strip club next to the car wash, the Spearmint Rhino. And this wasn't long after your mother said she wasn't sure if one of your ancestors died in childbirth or was struck by lightning. There just wasn't anyone left to set the story straight. And we started to feel old, and it snowed. The ice and salt and mud on the car made it look like how we felt on the inside. The dog was asleep on my lap. We had 7 more hours before our bed in the bluegrass would greet us like some southern cousin we forgot we had. Sometimes you have to look around at your life you've made and sort of nod at it, like someone moving their head up and down to a tune they like. New York City seemed years away, and all the radio stations had unfamiliar call letters and talked about God, the one that starts his name with a capital and wants you not to get so naked all the time. Sometimes there seems to be a halfway point between where you've been and everywhere else. And we were there. All the trees were dead, and the hills looked flat like in real bad landscape paintings in some nowhere gallery off an interstate, but still, it looked kind of pretty. Not because of the snow, but because you somehow found a decent song on the dial, and there you were, with your marvelous mouth, singing full-lunged, driving full speed into the gloomy thunderhead, glittery and blazing and alive. And it didn't matter what was beyond us, or what came before us, or what town we lived in, or where the money came from, or what new night might leave us hungry and reeling. We were simply going forward, riotous and windswept, and all too willing to be struck by something shining and mad and so furiously hot it could kill us.
Thank you so much. What a gift to hear that today. Every time I hear it, it just makes me feel so grateful to be here right now, no matter what I'm going through. I think there's that sense of time that you talk about often in your work that's in this too. There's that nostalgia, there's that looking back, that being in the middle, time passing part of this. And I think of how much you discuss time and grief and some of the same poems. And I think about my own like very limited understanding of Einstein's theory and time being a wave. And I lost my best friend who was like my sister to colon cancer last year, and I know that your Cynthia passed in that same way. And that theory of time being a wave has been something that's brought me a lot of comfort through my grief, this idea that there might be a buckling back at some point and we're just not meeting in the same moment on the line. And you have that beautiful poem, Time is on Fire. And I get a similar sense in that poem, of time being more expansive than we understand it to be. And I wonder if you can share that today or speak a little bit about that or anything related to time or grief.
Yeah, I love that you bring that up because first of all, I'm so sorry about the loss of your friend. And it's a grief is so interesting. I always find it really fascinating. Because it can be completely depleting, but then it also can be a way of loving. And continuing a love. And it's like the balance between deep sorrow, but then also the joy of having had a connection that warrants that kind of pain. And I think about that a lot with our lives and all of the wonderful people that we come into contact with, that we get to be alive at the same time at all. That we meet at all of that feels so lucky. And there are times when it feels as if we can't hold on to any of those things, that they will all disappear. And then there are also times where that makes me question the linearity of time at all. And I remember being at a reading. I think it was in Roanoke, Virginia. And someone had said, the way you play with time in your poems is so interesting. Like it's always like there's present, past, and future are all sort of mixing together. And how do you do that? And I just looked at them and I thought, I'm going to try to answer this as sincerely as possible. And I said, oh, because I don't think time exists. And he started laughing, and I was like, no, I mean, I don't know if it does. Like, I think it's all happening at once. And so, I'm always interested in also the physicists that can talk about time in an eloquent way, and us poets can only show it to you. And this was the poem that you're talking about. Time is on fire. I meet a physicist at the party and immediately ask him if it's true that time doesn't exist, time being important to me. Even now I'm older, time's crypt and wish and curl around me like ghost wind. He doesn't answer, so maybe I don't exist. One day, nothing. Another, mushrooms or mildew or some inchling sprout, some leaf gone black and dead. Time does that. The arrow we ride into the now, then into the future, does not pull out of the skin backward. Or does it? The past is happening. Pampas grass slicing the thumb before the dozer came and cut the grass out like a cancer. My old cat smoke leaving dead birds on the garden posts. The first man, the first woman. The madrone's rust-colored berries of fall, each second is in me. The arrow we ride like a horse, mute and fast, retraces and races, so that right now, Even as my valley burns, it rewinds too. Each black ash rubble pile pulls itself back into a dear home. A living cat leaps into the understory, and in the soft yellow hills, the first flame goes out.
So beautiful. Thank you so much. I love what you said about it all happening at once. I think that's how that's what it is to be human, that we're reliving our past and thinking of our future and being in the moment, like all together, all at once. And so how could you not write it that way, you know? And you do that so well. That poem is such a great comfort to me, the line about rewinding. Like it just feels like, oh yeah, we get to do that, and it will do that, and it moves backwards and forwards, and I really love it. Thank you.
Yeah, I really I don't think of myself as someone who is able to be eloquent or elucidate the ideas of time or philosophies about our nature. But I do think that the poems are the way that I make sense of my own emotionality around those giant topics. And to me, that's how I can make sense of it, is to really say it and show it at the, in the precise way that my brain is unveiling it to me.
Also how your body is experiencing it.
Yeah.
Like, when I first heard, I think it was last year, it was right around the time my friend passed, where they, you know, said, oh, it's proven that, you know, this theory is, we have proof of it now. And I became obsessed with understanding it. And then it was so hard for me to grasp. And then I thought, no, my own understanding of what that means is okay, because it's proof in my experience, you know? So I really relate to that too.
Yeah. I think there's a lot that can be said about that. Sometimes trying to intellectualize even the most fascinating, curious problem of existence still doesn't do the work a poem can do.
Yes, absolutely. This relates sort of to something I wanted to ask you about place, you know, knowing that you also grew up in California and you now live in Kentucky, how much I feel California and the landscape and the culture and the environment shaped who I am, and not just the way I think, but like my body, my physiology. I feel like that's something I explore or think about a lot, living in a new place, and then also how I metabolize this new place. And I think that's connected to what you were saying a little bit about, you know, the collapse of linear time, that we can be all the things all at once. But there's your poem Ancestors in the Carrying that I'd love to hear you read, but also if you could speak to, I don't know, the things you carry from the place in which you were born and raised, and then what you've absorbed about your life in a new place and landscape. And there's evidence, obviously, throughout all of your work of these things, and you write about it so beautifully, but I'd love to hear you talk about it in like a corporeal way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting to think about lineage, legacy, ancestors, the idea of home. Because I think it's so different for each individual, right? No one has the same experience. And yet there are so many people who are like, oh, this was the landscape I was raised on. This was this is what I think of when I think of water, you know, and how different when you think of the Atlantic Ocean versus the Pacific Ocean, when you think of a creek bed versus a river. And just to even think on a very elemental level that what we idealize as water, what we visualize in our brain, if telepathically I say I'm thinking about water and I want you to think of water, what does it look like for us? You know, what does a rainstorm look like? What does a and so the, you know, your experiences, you know, whether good or bad or supported or unsupported, whatever it is, those things still make an impression, an imprint on us as young people and people coming of age. And that to me has always been interesting because it means in some level that you were raised by human beings, but that you were also raised by place. And whether or not that was, you know, a high rise in the middle of downtown Brooklyn, or if it was, you know, a small house on, you know, in the woods, you know, anything that you do, there is always sort of a relationality that comes back to some of those initial core images of the body. And I think if you do, you know, if you do any kind of work like that and thinking about, you know, what's inside of us or where we come from, that comes up. You know, like I remember hearing a story from the great meditation teacher, Sharon Salzberg, who I got to opportunity to work with a long time ago when I first started meditating. She's amazing. And I mean, when I say work, I just attended her classes. It wasn't like a one-on-one thing or anything. She had no idea who I am, but she was doing a free series at the Tibet House in New York City. And she's really one of the reasons I started meditating, and have never stopped. And that was in 2007. And she had told the story, and I can't remember if she said it in person or if it was in her book, but that she was having everyone kind of do a meditation in the Northwest and talking about you know, just, you know, think about, you know, being a mountain, being as still as a mountain, and sort of containing this, you know, this stillness. And everyone kind of was laughing in the crowd, and she couldn't understand why. She said, "Well, here our mountains explode. Here our mountains are full of lava. They're alive. They rumble. They, you know." And so she was thinking about this stillness of the Berkshires, this sort of soft, you know, and here in the Pacific Northwest, there was a level of like, no, our mountains erupt. And they contain such a sort of powerful fury that everyone is constantly tracking and concerned about. And, you know, and so it was such a beautiful idea of that, even when we think about the metaphors of our life. You know, when I think about tree, what do I think of? You know, do you think of an evergreen? Do you think of a tree that never loses its leaves? How different is that than a tree that is literally consistently changing with the kind of seasons that you have in your town or in your landscape or in your city? And I think of that on a very basic level, that when we think of ourselves sort of disconnected from nature, and when everything is done on our phones and our emails, and we have to make a living, and unfortunately we live in a society where that doesn't seem like it's ending anytime soon, and so we have to make money. There's a level in which we do everything in this sort of vague gray space of a collective internet, you know, or a collective landscape of email, of language. And we forget that we are made of these initial pivotal images that really shape the archetype of our life. And I find that, to me, something that I go back to again and again in my work. The California landscape in particular, Moon Mountain, this the Valley of the Moon, Glen Ellen, Sonoma Valley. Those are places that I found out who I was, that I discovered what it was to be a being, and to be a being that was moving in the world and could move with it or against it. And how can we not, even if we don't treasure those experiences, how can we not acknowledge those experiences? And so that's a big part of who I am in my work. And I feel like sometimes you can imagine, little themes of your work going away. And that theme, I think, is only deepening in my work, because I'm only getting more and more curious about it.
It's so present in your work. It's a feeling I get when I read your work. And so it's this full circle moment for me that I've felt it all along. It's so beautiful. I think of always of Sharon saying that when you offer metta to yourself, it's as if you're holding the most delicate porcelain shell that could break at any moment, and that's how you offer to yourself and to the world. And that image has really stayed with me. And I feel that when I read your poems, that it's this handing over of this most delicate thing, even when you're talking about difficulties, Will you go back and just to the ancestors before I now I want to jump somewhere else, but I don't want to miss that one.
Of course. Ancestors was interesting for a couple of reasons, but one of them is that I really thought about that idea of where are you from? And that being asked of me, and as someone with Mexican heritage and being a Latina, I think there's a level in which people will ask you where you're from, and you can say California, but then they wait for the other answer. And sometimes it can be a beautiful question because it can give you an opportunity to bond with people who are also have ancestry outside of the United States, wherever that may be. And then there are also times where it feels almost like an othering that feels sort of purposeful or this strange value given or taken away. And so I thought, what if I just talked about ancestors as really the land? Ancestors. I've come here from the rocks, the bone-like chert, obsidian, lava rock. I've come here from the trees, chestnut, bay laurel, toyon, acacia, redwood, cedar, 1,000 oaks that bend with moss and old man's beard. I was born on a green couch on Carriger Road between the vineyards and the horse pasture. I don't remember what I first saw, the brick of light that unhinged me from the beginning. I don't remember my brother's face, my mother, my father. Later, I remember leaves through car windows, through bedroom windows, through the classroom window, the way they shaded and patterned the ground, all that power from roots. Imagine you must survive without running. I've come from the lacing patterns of leaves. I do not know where else I belong.
Thank you so much. One of my colleagues had a couple of questions that I think sort of go with this part of our conversation and the poem. And so I just want to pose those to you and see if you had any response. What are the ways that landscape connects with particular politics or desire for you? And how do you conceptualize the human and non-human relationship? What do land, fauna, and flora mean as projects of world making?
I think that at a very basic level, it is about acknowledging that the human is not at the center. It's not at the circle center. And I think that the more we recognize that, the more one, it's almost impossible to be lonely. And I know that there are so many people that suffer from loneliness,
Yes.
both young people and elders and people of all ages suffer deeply from loneliness. And I think that when you remind yourself or can be reminded that you belong to this planet, just simply the planet itself. A type of loneliness can go away. That doesn't mean you don't need other human connection and support and community, but I do feel like it's difficult to be lonely when you notice how alive the world is around you and how full of many, many different things and animals and plants and things really trying to live and flourish and survive. And that kind of connection, I think, is really powerful. And then secondly, I think that it really becomes about noticing, and getting out of the brain for a little while. And I love the brain, but to get out and actually recognize that this story, the narrative of yourself, is not the only story. It's not the most important story. It's not the hierarchy, where you are at the top and everything else is the minor characters. Instead, you are part of an ecosystem. You're part of something larger. And I think that even when we start to think about what harm we've done to the natural world or to landscape or to place, I still think that we have to also consider reciprocity, because if we only think of our relationship as one of harm, that too can sever us in a way that feels harmful. So I think that on many levels, recognizing that kind of connection towards all living things, makes room for a kind of grief that's really important, makes room for a rage and action. And then it also makes room for, I don't know if hope is the right word, but it makes room for a way of visualizing a new type of way of being, a new way of being in the world that's not just a colonizer mindset or an ownership mindset, but instead is one of mutual flourishing. I think a lot about Deepa Iyer's work about sort of the wheel of social justice and change, and how all types of people are needed in times when that require action and change. And you need the storytellers as well as the builders, you know, as well as the healers, as well as, and all of those things need to work together. And that doesn't mean stay in your lane, of course. You do whatever you want to do, but to a friend had told me very early on, and I wrote it down and I still think about it, and I don't even 100% know what it means, but I remember it's been on my fridge, you know, no longer my fridge, but it's somewhere in my papers. But it's she said, honor your medicine. And I think about that all the time. Like, what is that? Honor my medicine. And I think a lot of it is like, what is it that I do to heal? And in what ways can I offer any kind of healing outward? And I may not have the same kind of fire that I did, the same kind of rageful power that was very useful when it came to activism. And now I feel like I'm coming from a place that really wants to be centered on love. And it's very easy, I think, to feel like love is not powerful and it doesn't stand a chance next to anger. But I really think that as I've aged, it's sort of the only seat from which I want to offer things.
There's a few other things I really want to ask before our time is up. Are there questions of this moment that you're just exhilarated by and excited by and kind of engaged with in your daily life and practice and being?
Yeah. I mean, I love that because, poems exist in the questions, as, the wonderful Lucille Clifton taught us all. But I think that there is a the type of questions change. I still remember when I realized that the main question was, how do you live knowing that we all die, that everything that you love will go away? How do you live? And it shifted me entirely. 2010, a pivotal year for me in recognizing that I wanted to change that how I lived, because I needed to dedicate myself to a life that, if I could survive for a while, would offer something back. And, I feel like that question is still with me, because how can it not be, right? Mortality. There's a lot of people that will say all poems are love poems and all poems are elegies. And I think that's very true. So those will always be there. I feel like there is an awakening happening and a sense of awareness that's bigger than I've experienced in a while. And I'm interested in how that awakening might change us and might change our future. I'm also allowing myself, which I don't think I've allowed myself very often, to think about what would happen if we made powerful change together. I think that for so long, there's been so much sort of surrender to the doom of our inevitable future. I don't know. I've been meeting a lot of really inspiring young people moving through the world in this position as the laureate. And I'm learning a lot about myself. And I think one of the big lessons is that I think I speak to hope, but I think there has been a deep sort of skeptic in me that's always like, yeah, but the reality is X, Y, and Z. And I think I'm curious as to what it might be to envision, a new kind of future that might be entirely different and that has the potential to be collectively beautiful.
It's interesting how much resistance we carry towards opening, you said allowing ourselves to open towards that possibility. I share this experience of, meeting young people who carry this energy and show this. Again, I think we're so hesitant to use the word hope, but give me some kind of faith that it's not all on our shoulders to carry, and that there's ways of thinking that are so much more inventive and creative and than my way, and it's wonderful to see it. I wonder a little bit just about your practice, and how your poems live inside of your days and your body, and how you know when something is finished and when you think it takes the shape of a book or a collection, and how you put those things together, and do you feel inside of like a bigger framework or question, or that you're working inside of for a while, or does that happen more organically and then you kind of curate and weave and orchestrate? Yeah, just more about that.
Yeah, I mean, poems, I'm always working on poems on some level. Right now, it's National Poetry Month as we're recording this on the eclipse on April 8th, and I'm writing a poem a day. I've done this almost every April, since 2003. And
Wow.
so I every time I think, oh, I don't have time for that. And then I do it and I love it. And I get a lot of really awful little drafts, and then I get the beginnings of things that I will turn into poems. Many poems in my books have been written in the month of April because that is the time where I'm just sort of focused in it. And even when I'm very busy, like as I fly out tomorrow and then I'll fly back on Thursday, and then I have a trip that starts on Friday. So it's a sense of a lot of ongoingness. And yet your poems exist where you live, right? They don't just exist in some kind of protected, benevolent attic of the mind, they are in the airport with you. They're in the hospital with you. They're in, traffic with you. I think writing daily is really useful for me and as a reminder. So that's been a really beautiful process. It's something I do every year. I write also outside of that, but I write probably more like a poem every month or two. And then when they start to see them talking to each other, I start to consider, oh, this might be a manuscript. It usually takes someone else, because I've sent my poems out to readers and friends, and they'll go, oh, it looks like, I think you got enough for a new manuscript. I'll say, oh, no, I don't. And then I realize that they're right. And I suddenly start building from there. And when I start building from there, I do look at themes. I do look at things that are connected. I do look at central questions. And sometimes if there is like a very specific subject matter or a narrative, and many times there aren't, but if there is, I'll think, okay, well, if this poem is going to discuss what it's like being in a body that wants a child but can't conceive, I better write a poem about maybe not wanting a child, even in the middle of those processes. I think that that's the kind of prompts that I'll give myself, which is that I want to look, if I am going to play with something as a theme or as a narrative, then I want to be as free as I possibly can within that narrative. And I want to also explore it fully and be as truthful to myself. And that doesn't mean I include all the poems that I write, but I allow myself to go, oh, okay, if this is a central core or pulse or vein, then what are the other things that I haven't explored or haven't allowed myself to say or haven't allowed myself to write about because I'm either protecting myself or a future self. And so I think that that's when the books come into being, is that I will end up adding, sometimes 10 poems that are me pushing the boundaries of the original container of the idea. And right now, I'm interested because I'm doing it. The next book that I put out will be a new and selected, and that's very difficult for me because I've only ever written manuscripts. I've only ever written full books that are connected. And so pulling out poems feels a little hard for me. And yet I'm excited about also seeing the new and selected come into being as well. And I know that a lot of people, especially young people, being able to hold one book that has some of their favorites would be lovely. So I'm trying to think and consider those people in my heart as I make it. But of course, like any writer, I'm most excited about the new poems because whatever I'm working on in the moment is the thing that I'm most excited about.
Yeah. Will you talk a little bit about is it your mother, your stepmother that does the artwork, the
My
paintings?
mother, yeah, my mother did all the paintings on all of the covers for my books.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful collaboration. I send her the manuscripts and I often have a phone call with her where I'll give the sort of big words that are on my mind, whether it's like carrying, whether it's like, some kind of concept or something that's like that I've been playing with, and she'll write those in charcoal on her studio wall, and from there start to paint a series. And so most of these are one of a consecutive series that all are paintings based on the manuscripts, which is they're really beautiful, and it's just re really one of the deepest honors of my life to work with my mother in that way and to celebrate her artistic talent and allow us to kind of create an object in some ways that feels like it's made from both of us.
So amazing. I think it was when The Carrying came out that I realized that was what was happening, and that connection between you and her, and then talking about trying to conceive and, just all of the complicated experiences and emotions that go through a woman's life when thinking about mothering or carrying, and then your own mother sort of holding this, her was just such a wonderful connection. I think a lot about, and I'm writing a lot about microchimerism and the ways different cells live inside of you and are, what our mothers carried and what we pass on, and how women's bodies are this sort of accurate historical record of all of these impacts and in ways that male, bio male bodies are not. And I think it's really fascinating. And it makes me also think about the things that our bodies are made of and this interconnectedness that we've been talking about. And your poem, Dead Stars, and this kind of way in which we're all part of the same matter, in some sense. Do you mind ending with that poem today?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Thank
I'd be
you.
happy to. In fact, this poem came to me just the other day. I was thinking about this poem and the idea, the questions in it about what would happen, And I remember thinking about there's a, particular kind of surrender that sometimes we're sort of pushed to do because of our realities of this particular level of our existence. And I think this poem is a moment where I'm really trying to resist the surrender into the apocalyptic thinking, which is so easy to do. So, Dead Stars. Out here, there's a bowing even the trees are doing. Winter's icy hand at the back of all of us. Black bark, slick yellow leaves, a kind of stillness that feels so mute it's almost in another year. I am a hearth of spiders these days, a nest of trying. We point out the stars that make Orion as we take out the trash. The rolling container is a song of suburban thunder. It's almost romantic as we adjust the waxy blue recycling bin until you say, "Man, we should really learn some new constellations." And it's true. We keep forgetting about Antlia, Centaurus, Draco, Lacerta, Hydra, Lyra, Lynx. But mostly we're forgetting we're dead stars too. My mouth is full of dust, and I wish to reclaim the rising, to lean in the spotlight of streetlight with you, toward what's larger within us, toward how we were born. Look, we are not unspectacular things. We've come this far, survived this much. What would happen if we decided to survive more, to love harder? What if we stood up with our synapses and flesh and said no, no to the rising tides, stood for the many mute mouths of the sea, of the land? What would happen if we used our bodies to bargain for the safety of others, for Earth? If we declared a clean night, if we stopped being terrified? If we launched our demands into the sky, made ourselves so big people could point to us with the arrows they make in their minds, rolling their trash bins out after all of this is over.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It has been such a pleasure to talk with you.
You too, Ada. I'm so excited for the new and collected, and also for your anthology for your project. Do you just want to name that quickly?
Yeah, that just came out on April 2nd, so it's just new in the world. It's called You Are Here, Poetry in Nature. It's an anthology of 50 original contemporary nature poems, or poems that speak back to the natural world in some way at this urgent moment on our planet. And I couldn't be more happy with how it turned out. It's strange and wonderful. It is full of praise poems, it's full of grief poems, and it's really, I think, a book that is spanning the real landscape of this time and the real poetic landscape of this time.
The Electro Library Short Circuits is a production of the Stonehill College Digital Innovation Lab in conjunction with the English Department and the programs of Creative Writing and Digital Humanities.